This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 49, and I'm delighted to welcome Rich Wagner, Chairman of the Emerging Payments Association, to discuss fair access to the payments network for fintechs. The EPA, which is based in London, in passing, houses the world's only incubator for paytech fintechs. This is a real hardcore topic, a long way away from the fluffy bunnies and the cheerleaders in their short skirts, which I have to say, in my humble opinion, never look that good on men anyway. So where do we start? One simple way in is the recent podcast LFP046, Payments Theory, Practice and Laughs with Hiroki Takeuchi, CEO of GoCardless. There he split payments mechanisms into credit cards, push and pull. GoCardless specialise in pull, direct debits to folks in the UK, and to do that, as he explained, they need to build relationships with the banks. The factoid that sticks in my mind the most from that is that to integrate, say, Canada into their pull network would take them a year, which gives you some feel of how hard it is for a non-bank to do payments. Another angle is the establishment of the PSR, the Payments Systems Regulator, which uniquely in UKFS is an economic regulator alone and focuses on opening up access at a much lower level of the infrastructure to non-banks. Rich Wagner was the star of LFP031, Payments and Non-Bank Banking, and is the CEO of Advanced Payment Solutions. They, a non-bank formed 12 years ago, have processed over £4 billion of payments, have over 1.2 million cash plus cards out there, and provide banking solutions for 30% of UK local authorities. So another real hardcore player and an expert. Such is the power of the London FinTech Podcast that Rich subsequently also became the chairman of the Emerging Payments Association, and is wearing that hat that he appears today. I'll include a link in the show notes to their recent report entitled Payment Infrastructure, A Call for Fair and Equal Access for FinTech. He's an ideal guide to explain to us the changing landscape of payment systems that were designed a long time before fintech was ever thought of, a need to operate with roughly 99.99999% accuracy every day for zillions of pounds. Clearly, you don't want just any old startup APIing into that. But neither should banks have a monopoly over payments, which, to cut a long story short, is where the PSR is coming from. There's also the context that the current system is creaking. One incident last year resulted in a high street bank having to disclose 600,000 missing payments in the faster payment scheme. And by the way, I've heard of far bigger numbers in the past myself. Imagine being a payments fintech that happened to be running on the rails of that bank. There's also a pricing angle. The number 600 cropping up again in terms of the 600% markup being paid for access to the systems on some occasions. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Rich. Thanks for joining me again today.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thanks for the introductory remarks. Certainly, paytech, fintech, whatever you want to call it, definitely has an opportunity to improve over the last 50 years. And certainly, one of the big things that I've been promoting is access. As part of the industry, I do it for ourselves as speaking for APS, but certainly it's been a long time in coming to allow a wider group of individuals to have access that the bank's been enjoying for many years previously.
Absolutely. Well, I'm rather worried at a much simpler level than that. That as you were on the show last year, you picked up a new role, that once you're coming back on the show again, you'll have another role. So perhaps in a year's time, I'll be coming back and you'll be running APS, the EPA, and perhaps chairman of the Payment Systems Regulator as well, being the first person ever to run a company and the regulator at the same time, which would be a much more transparent mechanism, of course.
Well, if, Mike, you and your podcast can do that, then certainly I will continue to do podcasts with you.
Excellent. Megalomania, it always helps.
Yeah.
And we were talking before about passports, as I'm about to go off to a new country for me, Morocco, for a few days. And you were saying that you were in Cuba recently.
Yes, I was, actually. I'm a dual passport holder. I share my allegiance to both the US and the UK. And I do it primarily selfishly so I can go to the shortest line at the immigration office. But in Cuba, certainly it was the first time I ever went to a country and I left my US passports at home, because although the country is opening up to America, and I was there when Obama was there. It's not a place to get in with your U.S. passport at the current time.
I see. So you think the president left his U.S. passport at home, did you? Or was he at a special queue?
I think he had a special queue with the Air Force One flying into the airport. I don't think he had to go through immigration like I did.
Ah, so there's advantages after all. The one thing I can recommend to people if they haven't heard of it, I was last night watching one of the episodes. Oliver Stone and some historian professor whose name now escapes me did a series on PBS in the States called The Untold History of the United States, which is really sort of rather fascinating and, of course, completely different from probably what you were taught in school about US history and how the Cold War and all those kind of things operated. So I recommend people check that out. So moving on to more mundane matters than American foreign policy and Cuba and passports. So do you want to tell us briefly about the EPA, as I'm calling it?
Emerging Payments Association is what its full name.
Is the association emerging, or is it Emerging Payments Commerce Association?
Well, I'm hoping it's more the emerging payments who actually form a group that basically move the industry forward. But it's a collection of currently 75 what we consider innovative, progressive payment companies who basically share a similar vision that, you know what, the collective can actually do more than individuals. And as much as I've tried to influence the payment space over the past 15 years that I've been in the UK, doing it with a collective group, people as smart, if not smarter than I, working together on common themes, actually can bring forth more rapid change within payments by simply doing it on their own.
So basically, it's a kind of trade body in a way.
Yeah, a little bit. I would say Tony, who basically leads the cause for EPA, it's more than just a trade body of actually doing that. It's about educating people within the body. I mean, the one thing about payments, you know, I think you made a good comment about Go Cardless. Payments is a complicated space. It's a regulatory space. It's a space which has its own complexities of trying to build new things on top of a very, very old infrastructure. And those that get it right really need to understand the bits and bytes about it. And I think what the EPA does in a lot of respects is does do a lot of education of why things are the way they are and why we think we should change it, and also giving the how to do it. And I think by putting those three things to do, many trade associations just say, basically, we need to change without the how. And we try to basically put the how and what you should do to make it a better payments ecosystem.
Well, I have to say, without sort of being sycophantic and groveling, I did actually read the paper, of course, and I thought it was well written. And the thing that struck me was the way that you're busy trying to get a good deal for all sides, for the people trying to get the access, for the incumbents who have spent a fortune, gazillion dollars in the past, and for people like the Bank of England, we'll come on to in a minute why they're important as well. So I think that you guys are doing a grand job. So going on to the current state of the UK payments network, before we talk about how you're trying to change it and where you'd like to see it going, as I mentioned, just using Hiroki's topology, we've got credit cards, we've got push mechanisms, and we've got pull mechanisms as the three basic ways of doing payments. So the emerging payments, he says, emphasizing the word payments rather than emerging, the Emerging Payments Association, which of those three does it focus on? Which does it cover? Or does it cover all three?
The association is made up of members who basically participate in the entire ecosystem, push, pull, settle. We try to look at, from an EPA perspective, look after the interests of all those parties. Moving money from point A to point B, no matter how you look at it, push, pull, is something that we're keen on making it better for the industry and thus better for the consumers and SMEs that actually use the ecosystem.
Yeah, so as I understand it, the ones that are uniquely UK in this equation are the FPS, faster payments, the banks, and the direct debit. Credit cards, the main point of credit cards, of course, being that they've got, I'm glossing over the surface here.
Yeah.
They've got one system worldwide. But when it comes to push and pull, each country tends to have its own system. Is that roughly right?
That is correct. And even when we look at faster payments and the work that UK have done, and I would say the UK, being independent because I'm not British, actually I would say the UK are one of the leaders in bringing real-time payments to the payments industry. You go elsewhere outside and you can actually use my other country as an example. It still takes 3 days to move money from point A to point B, where it takes 5 seconds to move money in this country.
Right, and I think the other point that is relevant here, which is that although we're just talking about UK systems here and UK schemes, which will have similarities and differences with other countries, the basic pro forma of what you guys are about could be lifted and amended for the sake of argument, in Germany, US, Spain, the same arguments with different players would apply.
Yep.
And a lot of the thinking and a lot of the logic behind this is really how you graft the modern world onto the old rails, whatever they are. So I think it's got a much broader context outside the UK, but let's just constrain ourselves to the UK for the moment. So at the moment, we've got these three main schemes. And what are the rules on who can access them?
Well, if you just even draw the clock back maybe 12, 18 months, really it was the banks that could have access to the schemes and the settlement systems to basically move money. And to be fair, when you talk about the clearing banks, you're talking only about not just the wider people that have banking license, but people that actually had clearing capabilities. And you're talking about people on one hand, you know, less than five players. And you're talking the real big high street players that actually had that ecosystem to themselves.
Yes, you're taking me back to old-fashioned vocabulary when people use vocabulary like clearing banks. Merchant banks didn't used to be called that. They used to be called accepting houses because they would accept bills of exchange and they were issuing houses. So it's interesting that some of that language is still kind of literally meant from that context when a clearing bank cleared payments.
Yes.
And so it's really the case that's just only a handful of clearing banks still.
Yep. And right now, I looked at the website, Faster Payments, to have the most updated information. There are only 10 members of Faster Payments today. And those are basically full-fledged licensed banks. Most of them are basically just processing their own payments. Only a subset of those actually leverage the capability to allow other people like us, who are non-banks, access into that system.
Okay, and it's an interesting thing. I mean, I haven't done one of these app-only banks, but I have heard a number of them talk, and I don't think a lot of them are actually ready to be on the show at this stage. But in terms of the sort of fluffy bunny, superficial attitude, people talk about banks as if a bank was a kind of thing that did one thing. But in practice, there are banks that do a whole variety of stuff. And, you know, with the new challenger banks, so-called challenger banks like Aldermore, Shawbrook, and Metro, would those be clearing banks, or are they banks who don't do clearing?
Well, it's a great question because I think people don't realize that of the 10 members of Faster Payments, those three banks are not on the list. They actually used to basically buy those services. So they're a bank, but they bought their services from a clearing bank and were under the same issues that we are under in terms of flexibility of technology. They probably got a better cost because they had volumes, but still a higher cost than actually going direct. And some of the governance and oversight that a clearing bank may have might not be the same as the governance process of a more innovative challenger bank.
So it is interesting because quite often one sees this kind of thing glossed in the press as it being only about giving access to the payment system to, say, fintechs,
yeah,
or non-banks. But actually, for what we're talking about here, in many cases, some banks don't have access to it.
That is correct.
In fact, perhaps the majority of banks in the UK don't have access to it.
Yeah, actually, the majority of banks in the UK who operate as banks and can say that they are a bank do not have access to the payment systems.
Interesting. So then moving on in terms of the current scheme, there was a great phrase. As I say, I like the report largely because it was simple, clear and direct, and listeners will see why in a few seconds. There was a great quote in the report about the state of play of the IT infrastructure that runs this mass of payments. And I quote, "Convoluted mess of system upgrades on top of antiquated architecture, which struggles to keep pace with today's digital financial demands." Which certainly wins nice prizes for clear English and directness.
Well, you mentioned in the introduction the 600,000 payments that were basically lost, mishandled, but just didn't post for customers. Unfortunately, a large number of our customers were part of that 600,000. And it wasn't the fact that this high street bank actually lost them. It was the fact that the time it took to figure out that they had the problem and to actually figure out where these payments actually ended up. It's one thing to know that you lost them, but it's the other thing of how long does it take to actually recover them? And both were abysmally slow and really reflected the archaicness of their systems where they weren't able to basically react in a time frame that I think customers are expecting and clients who use their services are expecting.
Yes, I sat next to, when I was doing a gig at a bank, some guy who's got decades in FS, and he was trying to move house on a particular Friday a few years ago, and I think it was RBS's payments thing which just failed. And of course, it causes huge disasters in that kind of stuff. You've got a chain of housing, A pays B, pays C, pays D, And if one of those is going through RBS, it breaks down. It's a complete bloody disaster. So he was going through huge stress. And then I subsequently found out that that bank everyone had been in the whole weekend because they'd lost some, it's like gazillions of dollars have just gone missing. And it was that kind of stuff, you know? And again, to somebody from outside FS or even somebody from in FS, I sat there and thought, how can you lose all that kind of stuff? You know, it's kind of crazy. So I guess it does raise the question, which I'm not sure is mentioned in the report, but it's all very well increasing access to this convoluted mess, but at some point in time, presumably, the whole thing needs, quotes, re-engineering, doesn't it? Because if you've got a messy system and more people pile into it kind of stuff.
Well, let's be clear. The messy systems are usually from the existing high street clearing banks who built these systems 50 years ago. What I think is happening now, and if you fast forward in terms of where the environment is now, you have a much larger group of people getting access, and you have a number of technology enablers and organizations that have built from scratch new access capability into these schemes, which kind of gives you a new white piece of paper, brand new systems that actually get you out of the legacy systems of the old clearing banks. So there is a light at the end of the tunnel that includes more participation, but more participation on a better infrastructure and technology.
Right. So, well, maybe that's a good point to go into a little bit more about what the architecture as a whole looks like. Some topic I never thought I'd find myself piling into, but just as somebody who occasionally reads the financial press, in terms of systems, you get words like Vocalink, ACI, FIS. I mean, what is the sort of the coremost system here? Well, we talk about payment systems. What are these systems?
I think that the payment system schemes are the ones we talked about faster payments, BACs, and direct debit. If you're talking about basically the technology aggregators, Vocalink was the only game in town for a very long time. The clearing banks basically used Vocalink to basically move these payments from point A to point B.
So Vocalink is software in a sense, is it?
Yeah, it is software. It's the ecosystem. It's software and hardware to basically move your payment from point A to point B.
So just to ask a simple question, is there kind of, quotes, metaphorically speaking, a computer somewhere under the ground in London, which is the payments computer and it all goes through there?
For Vocalink, that's probably a good analogy from a simplistic standpoint. But I think what's going on now is that a wider group of players are now able to participate and get certified with the schemes, primarily the early schemes being faster payments who are ahead of the schedule, of allowing people like FIS and Vocalink to be independently certified. And there's probably 6 or 7 more technology providers which will do a couple things. One, it will allow people like us choice, and by having greater choice, the competitive pressure to provide us a competitive price of basically getting hooked into these systems will also improve. So that's a big change from only having one technology player into a couple schemes to 6 or 7 technology providers that will actually give us direct capability to get into these schemes.
Right. And at this point, I'm wishing that peer-to-peer didn't mean something else in fintech, but using peer-to-peer in a computer science, in an IT perspective, which is I send you an MP3 file and you send it to your daughter and she sends it to her friend and that kind of stuff. Have we basically got sort of a client-server architecture, or is peer-to-peer payments coming in? Do they all have to pass through, quotes, one place, one centralized database at the point?
Yeah, this is going through a central point. Wow. The central point being basically in the initial phase is basically faster payments. Faster payments will know where everything's going, but you got to realize is that not only do you have faster payments, but you do have BACs, which is an independent scheme where you actually have payments going through there. So that's a centralized solution. It provides a different outcome, and you've got faster payments, which actually is a different system. If you go through that, all the payments will go through there, but they are centralized infrastructures from which we and the previous banks have ridden on for many years.
And again, just mentioning Vocalink and this sort of few things I do know, as I recall, it was set up and it's owned by the banks?
It's owned by the banks. And that's where the payment system regulator is a little bit concerned about basically this leveling the playing field, allowing people like us to have access. It's kind of perverse to think that I would go to Vocalink as a non-bank and ask for their technology solution, when in fact the commercial proposition would be coming from Vocalink, who is owned by the banks. And would that be enough independence to give me a fair deal? the PSR are saying no, and that's why they're suggesting that Vocalink need to break up and actually be far more independent, because they're going to be servicing more than just banks, and thus, by doing that, they need to break that ownership of the banks who previously owned them.
Yes, this is just sort of just random, but you know, one simple way, would be for quotes for against just schematically, say the Bank of England, which we all know, which is in the heart of the city and sits at the centre of the financial system. Let's say, for example, it just bought Vocalink from the banks. Then in the Bank of England would do the creation of money, which it does.
Yep.
And it would do the sort of the payments thing. But however, Vocalink and these other systems are these central ones. So how does the technical access for non-banks work then? So you say you've done £4 billion of payments. How did you do them?
I have gone through one of the high street providers, and they basically provided me indirect. One of the models is indirect access. So that's currently I have indirect access, and I want direct access. And for right now, the movement within faster payments, the schemes, has all been around basically moving away from just a single model to get access to a choice, a menu choice for people. And in fact, you've got three choices now. You can go indirect, as we are today. You can actually do direct agency access, which is highlighted in my paper, and one that is promoted quite heavily by a recent paper that came out from Raffles, who are going to play that role in this ecosystem. And then there's basically the ultimate goal of, if you can afford it and you can basically do it yourself, you can have direct access on your own.
Now, I think on this direct access on your own, let's assume for the sake of argument, someone waves a magic wand, the PSR waves a magic wand, and suddenly everyone's allowed to have access, subject to conditions, terms and conditions apply. I was quite surprised by the cost of doing it in terms of IT spend.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I remember getting a quote from Vocalink about 5 years ago, and I almost fell off my chair. It was a cost as a growing small organization, we would not be able to do even if we wanted. If we thought it was the number one priority, the single thing we want to do, it was so expensive, we wouldn't even take it into consideration.
So taking it out of the commercial domain of what they were quoting to you, I've got at the top of my head something like banks, it would cost millions to get into
millions,
it.
Millions, yeah. You put seven figures on that, and it's within that range. And for a small fintech, a startup fintech, they're not going to basically throw a million, you know, and I don't say a million because it was multi-million, pounds at a single solution for their basically product proposition, when in fact the alternative is that you could rent it from the banks for, yes, a unit cost that may be, you know, six times more expensive than if you went direct, but at least you wouldn't be burdened with a multi-million pound upfront investment.
And as you were saying, FPS is more modern than banks, so quotes is easier to do. They're the implementation cost you guys are quoting is about £500,000 anyway.
Yeah, and that's come about because of a couple things. One, Faster Payments is a more modern infrastructure than BACS, just because they started later in the process. It's no disrespect to BACS. And you've got these technology integrators who are going to basically do a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of the payment certification so that you get this 100% uptime and 100% reliability. And they'll spread that cost over the individuals that actually hook into that infrastructure. Again, lowering the cost from the multi-millions down to, you know, maybe £500,000. Again, £500,000, though, is still a lot of money for the majority of fintechs and even the majority of the emerging payment members that participate in this ecosystem.
Yes, in a world where everyone's used to just being able to have an API, which they knock up in an afternoon.
Yeah, £500,000 and really probably 4 months or 5 months of certification. You know, again, these are payments, they're sensitive, and there is a serious amount of work to get to this point of what everybody wants. And I think certainly some of the alternative solutions of, yes, you know, I'm at a stage where CEO of APS, I want direct access because I, you know, after 10 years of doing this, I'm at a scale where I've got the money and the resources, the technology, and the people capability to do it. But there are a lot of players out there that shouldn't be tied simply by the financials. And I think this whole direct agency model, where actually they get help from a sponsoring bank, and I say people like Raffles and such, where they're there as a kind of a buffer and a settlement partner for these providers. They will help actually widen the scope of people that can actually take advantage of the new technologies without actually incurring a significant amount of costs in terms of that £500,000. So there's some great models in there now that are giving flexibility to a lot of different players in the market based on their appetite and their ability to actually take advantage of one of those models.
Right. And I think one of the things that's been implicit in everything we've said so far, but we should probably make explicit, is that all of these conversations about opening up access to the payments network isn't about opening it up to everybody. You're not, for example, proposing that the London FinTech podcast be able to interface to payment systems, even if I had 500,000 to spend on it. And I think one of the things that might be worth just touching on is the fact that there's a whole bunch of regulation around what it is to be a bank, but there are many more, should we say, non-bank banks, to use the first loosely, doing some banking activities who aren't banks, but they're definitely regulated, as are you.
Yeah, I do think it should be a regulated entity that basically participates in this ecosystem because they understand money laundering, KYC, KYB, and all the things that actually you're required to do to make sure that you are prudently understanding the source of funds. And once you do understand that, you understand how to move that money from point A to point B in a responsible way. And so from that perspective, I do think it is that where we've always had a problem, and I say the EPA have always had a problem, and it's been a bugbear of me as a CEO of a fintech payment service provider, is they would categorize certain groups. So basically, well, I'm not a bank, so you can't join. Or I participate as a money service business, so basically we don't want you part of the club. They were making artificial and widespread exclusion criteria. You know, to be honest, as long as you basically were part of the regulated community, you had the governance structures, you had the money to basically getting implemented, no one should be prevented in that regulated world from access. And I think that's been our issue at EPA and my big issue and pet peeve as the CEO of APS.
And just on a small point, when you say regulated, regulated by whom? FCA, Bank of England?
Now that a lot of the credit institutions have moved over to the FCA, pretty much it's really the FCA, the PRA. Bank of England, from a PRA perspective, only really regulates the banks. But it's really the FCA is really where you're looking at. And you're looking at both outside of the banking community, you're probably looking at the credit institutions, you're looking at e-money institutions, and you're looking at payment institutions. And within payment institutions, you also have small payment institutions. But that regulatory hierarchy, those are the people should be able to participate regardless.
So to cut a long story short, the essence of this is that the people who are doing payments at the moment and who would like access to these systems are basically regulated by the same financial services regulators that regulate the banks.
That's correct.
They're in the same building.
That's right. And that's why I think the one thing that the UK did a great job of is actually establishing a separate economic regulator, the PSR, because I don't think we would have seen the momentum that we have seen in the last 12 months, to your point, if the FCA was directly responsible, because you almost have a conflict of interest in the FCA because they're basically regulating the banks, and do they really want to regulate any more people? The answer is probably no. Setting up the payment systems regulator really kind of put a shock to the system and had some independents out there that was trying to look after the benefit to the consumer. And the benefit to the consumer is to widen the market, put more participants in it, so that you're going to be able to do your payments, you know, 5 years from now at one-fifth the cost of it is today.
Yes, it's interesting because most regulation, I feel, around the world tends to lead towards oligopolies, whether it's in telecoms or pharmaceuticals or what have you, because it increases the cost of business. But the PSR is one which is one of the few examples of anti-oligopolistic regulation. And it'd be interesting to see in the fullness of time, 5 to 10 years' time, how the oligopolists actually manage to handle a regulator like that.
Well, it's true. I mean, we're never going to lose the side of the banks. And people say, oh, death the banks and stuff. The banks are going to be around. But when people used to have a bank, there is so much a bank does, certainly 10 years ago, that, hey, there are things that basically other people can do a lot better. And I think there's going to be a lot more niche banking that's going to happen over the next 5, 10 years. And it's not the eliminating the banks. Banks are going to still do corporate treasury. They're never going to trust a guy like me to move 10 million pounds from here to New York. They're going to use a JP Morgan. They're going to use a Citibank. But hey, Joe consumer on the street, you know, they might want to basically move that money within nanoseconds in a nice fancy looking app. JP Morgan is not going to have a fancy looking app, but maybe I will, maybe TransferWise will, maybe Currency Cloud will. These are the type of people that basically the consumers will probably want to deal with more than the old, more traditional banks.
Yes. So it's probably a good time to move on to why this is challenging and why it's quite hard work. One of the obvious reasons is that banks set it all up in the first place. They've spent a fortune on it. And to the extent that they may be making excess profits at the moment, why do they want more people in the club sharing it? It's a bit like a golf club. You limit the number of members of Wentworth.
Yep.
And the cost of entering. But what are the three main reasons that you see that it's hard to get this moving as fast as you'd like it to move?
Well, you mentioned the first one. I mean, I think the traditional banks have had its play in this space, and there really has been no motivation from anyone, including the regulators, to really make that move. And luckily, we do have the payment system regulator to thank to making that move. I think getting the schemes just to literally provide membership access is a big first step. And, people thought, oh, it's going to take years to do. Hey, no, faster payments. Greg, who leads the charge at Faster Payments as a CEO, done a great job in actually making that happen. So today I can actually have access. Technology and the price of the components, I think, have been really preventing a lot of people to play. I think the model that they came up with, actually creating technology aggregators to allow the access, has actually lowered the cost to allow more people to participate. Not everyone, but more people to participate.
When you say technology aggregators,
basically those individuals that are going to basically take technology elements and get it certified within the schemes to allow us to move money. This is the FIS, the VocaLinks, the ACIs of the world, who will actually provide this gateway into the schemes rather than us trying to build it individually.
Okay, and again, those are the people who know what it takes because they run the system at the moment anyway. It's not like a fintech knocking up its own piece of software and trying to plug it on the outside of this computer under the ground.
Yeah, it's sort of like somebody saying, for me, I've always stated that, hey, MasterCard and Visa are a great brand. Am I going to create the Rich Wagner brand and basically create this new payment scheme? No. They spend billions.
There is a limit to your megalomania then.
Yeah, exactly. The Rich Wagner credit card brand, it's not going to happen. But that's exactly what these technology aggregators, I don't want to rebuild that integration every single time. I don't want each of the fintech players having to recertify through a very lengthy and very complex process. If these technology aggregators, payment gateways, can get certified once, I just plug into a certified technology partner, makes my cost less, and provides even an economic viable model for all participants to play in.
So then I think the last element we haven't mentioned on this so far is the Bank of England settlement accounts.
Yes.
With which I'm not strangely unfamiliar. So maybe you can just remind me, because sure I do know.
Well, I do find it interesting, and I've had the opportunity in sitting in the lobby of the Bank of England, and I've actually got a friend of mine, actually, who works at the Bank of England. And it's quite interesting. As the Bank of England, the only people that can open up a bank account at the Bank of England are actually two groups of people. One, the banks, only the banks. And actually, if you are an employee of the Bank of England.
Oh, yes, I knew the second one. I had forgotten that one. Yeah.
People don't realize that, but it's a pretty cool benefit.
It's a good checkbook to have.
It's a good checkbook to have. They have sort code 000001. But that's been a big challenge. But I think because we're still excited that it's just around the corner, not that the Bank of England is going to make a big change. The challenge is that all the schemes have been built on the fact that all parties will settle via the Bank of England. Well, actually, it's fine for BACs and Faster Payments more specifically to say, hey, Rich Wagner of APS, you can join our club. Fine to join a club, but if I need to basically pay my dues into a bank that I can't join, then I really can't pay my dues. So ultimately, what we've got is a roadblock a little bit within the Bank of England.
And your mate there won't let you use his account at the Bank of England.
Correct. But what's happening, though, is you're seeing innovative players like Raffles seeing this as a market opportunity. Raffles have done all the heavy lifting and worked to be a permission for deposit-taking bank, a credit institution. They have the authority to actually have a settlement account at the Bank of England. They know a lot of fintech players aren't going to be able to get a Bank of England bank account for probably some time. My view is probably about 2 years, but If that's the case, I think Raffles are in a great position to take advantage of this and allow parties, even parties like myself, to leverage their credit institution status, their banking status, and provide that one missing piece in this whole ecosystem to allow the whole industry to move forward at least a couple steps while we wait for the Bank of England to open up their access.
Now, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that one. And as you say, it is the missing link, because that's the thing that you need to make it all happen. And from a wider perspective, I think one thing that doesn't come out of this is that the other classes, such as advanced payment solutions, as I remember from last year, of, shall we say, non-bank banks, just to keep it simple, actually are far lower risk organisations than banks. In that, if I deposit a bunch of money with you,
yes,
for my ill-gotten profits from the podcast, which wouldn't be a lot so far, you would have to keep the same amount.
Yeah.
So actually, quotes, you are less risky, unquotes, famous last words, but you're less risky than RBS.
We have been trying to share with the regulator that in the e-money world, the way that you built it actually was pretty good for the consumer, because actually I hold, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds of customer money. If in some remote circumstance, people don't feel trusted with the way that I'm managing their money, I don't put a systemic risk on the industry. If basically every one of my customers went out tomorrow and withdrew all their money from their ATM, I'd be able to manage it. We would not be in Northern Rock.
Absolutely. So this is the irony, wearing my risk hat for a moment. The irony is that the riskier players in the financial system, the major banks, are allowed access to Bank of England settlement accounts, whereas the less risky players are not. That's a historical accident. Well, I think that's been a sort of very clear deep dive under the bonnet, mixing all my metaphors, deep dive under the bonnet maybe, about what's going on at the moment and how you guys are pushing forwards. I think what's very clear from this is that without the payment systems regulator and without the association, the Emerging Payments Association, pushing this, none of this would have happened. So going back to the world of fintechs, everyone can write exciting so-called thought leader posts on LinkedIn using all the buzzwords. But in practice, it requires some hardcore stuff like this, some real heavy lifting to change things deep in the infrastructure. And it's only deep in the infrastructure can you make big differences. Otherwise, you're just doing a pretty app on top of a sort of Citigroup bank account sitting behind it. So do you want to just wave the flag for the Emerging Payments Association then, Rich? As I've seen that some of the names there I recognise, and equally some names that I know aren't there.
You know, I think the EPA fly the flag for all paytech and fintech organizations, whether you're a member or not. They're running basically three major streams of work. I try to focus Tony's time into very distinct deliverable agenda items, one of them being basically what we call Project Rome. And Rome is all around direct access. It's about basically providing the non-banks the ability to have access to the payment.
Is that because all roads lead to Rome?
All roads lead to Rome.
It's also a long way away, though.
Yeah, the other cheeky comment that we say is that Rome wasn't built in a day.
Oh, very good, yes.
And we know that this environment, and as much as, you know, fintech players like to move fast and quick and nimble, we recognize as we fly the flag for the EPA and the payment industry as a whole, we know that the regulators, the Bank of England, the scheme operators may not move as fast as we want. We have realistic expectations, and there has been fantastic progress. And, you know, thanks to the PSR, and I think groups like the EPA and passionate parties like ourselves at NAPS, Raffles, Bancorp, and a lot of other of the members that basically sit at the heart of the EPA, really pushing the same common theme through the ecosystem. And that's a big element. But that's just one, you know, one little aspect, a big aspect of what EPA does, but we're there in terms of providing leadership and thought leadership, and thanks to people like yourself allowing us to speak about the EPA. But we do it across the board, at whether it be at Money 2020 Europe conference that happened last week, or some of the regulatory thought leadership that needs to happen. And if somebody basically calls us up from the PSR and they need some industry expertise, we're there to help. And the last thing that basically the EPA does is a project called Project Catalyst, where we're helping and incubating very, you know, small fintech organizations. And many of these folks have really great ideas, and they have a new innovative spin on payments, who need a little bit help in terms of understanding the payment ecosystem. And we're there helping and educating them, showing them how to actually make their business actually a real business rather than just a cool payment idea. And those are the three themes that play out in the EPA, and we hope that more people will join us. And you mentioned, you know, Go Cardless. You know, they are not a member, and certainly those and the thousands of electronic money issuers and non-bank players in this ecosystem, the more players that are basically with the EPA, the more power and influence we can have over making changes, positive changes in the industry in the UK, and hopefully even further afield throughout Europe.
Well, I think that's a very good summary to end on, Rich. In the tech world, you can sit down there and write your app and release it into the world, and it can be famous in a year's time, and you can make billions. But in the fintech world, you're existing in a much more regulated context, a context where this kind of activity has been going on for centuries, and it comes with a whole bunch of issues. And therefore, to actually be a very good paytech, you need to understand something of that context. You do need the people with grey hair and no hair to help you understand how things are, at the same time as bringing your new innovative, sexy ideas into what has been a relatively stale industry until recent times. So thanks for that, Rich, and I'm sure you'll give a special prize to all people who call in.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.